start?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to call this meeting to order. Welcome. This is the February 13th, 2018 meeting of the Central Marin Sanitation Agency Commission. First up, Pledge of Allegiance. Would you all please join me?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Can you please have the roll call?
Mr. First. Diane First.
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Here.
Dean DiGiovanni.
Here.
Michael Borstein.
Here.
Thomas Gaffney.
Here.
And John Hilmer.
Here.
Thank you.
Next up on the agenda is open time for public participation. This is the time we set aside for any member of the public to speak on anything not on tonight's agenda. Would anybody like to make any comments? Seeing none, we will move on. I wanted to report out on the January 30th, 2018 special board meeting. We had a closed session. We did report out after the closed session, but since nobody was here, we thought we'd report out again. We have given direction to staff, and there is nothing to report at this time. Unless, Jason, did you want me to give the basic overview that...
Sure.
Yeah, we're CMSA is not taking action on the appeal of the NPDES permit. So we're going in wait and see mode on that pending permit. Thank you. Next up is the consent calendar. All items will be passed in one motion unless anybody would like to pull an item. Any member of the public, staff, or the board can pull any item if necessary. Anybody want to pull anything? Not an entertain a motion.
I move to accept the consent calendar.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? I believe that was unanimous. Thank you. Agenda item 6, 2018 National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permit Presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Chair First. So, as you know, the Regional Water Board adopted the agency's NPDES permit on January 10th at their hearing. And as you also know, that our GP member agency that own and operate the collection systems are co-permittees, and the permit becomes effective on March 1st of this year. And with that, I'll introduce Monica Oakley, our regulatory consultant, and she's been our consultant now through this a few permit cycles, right?
This is the fourth NPDES permit that I've assisted CMSA with.
Three with me and one with my predecessor. Okay. But Monica's done a great job for us over the years, and we appreciate all her help. So she's going to give the presentation, and if you can turn that on there, Kate.
Tom,
you want to
give your turn?
Okay, thank you, Jason. So I'll just start out by... saying that, as you can see from the packet, that National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System is a federal program under the Clean Water Act that was originally enacted in 1972. And so the permit, the NPDES permit, is a federal and a state permit. It's issued by the Regional Water Quality Control Board, which is a state agency, and they reside in Oakland. And they do it under the federal authority that's delegated to California by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The U.S. EPA is very influential in the NPDES permit development process with the Regional Water Board. The NPDES permit lasts for 5 years each time. However, in the last few days, you saw that the White House issued the infrastructure plan and fiscal year budget, and that... has in it a proposal to change the NPDES permit term from 5 years, which is what it's been since 1972, to 15 years. So that would be a big change.
That's great.
No. If that happens. We'll see what happens with it. But
so CASA and NACWA have been advocating for a 10-year permit. So, you know, each year I go back to D.C., and one of the key messages is, you know, increasing the permit to 10 years. So we're glad to see it being 15 years in the White House proposal, and they will negotiate it down to 10. So that's good.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, For this particular permit renewal, we submitted an application a little more than a year ago in early 2017. Then the Regional Water Board staff worked on the permit and issued a draft for public review in September of last year that's called a tentative order. The permit was adopted last month in January, and it becomes effective, as Jason said, on March 1st in a couple of weeks. The permit expires in 5 years in February of 2023. A really important part of the permit includes numeric effluent limits, and there are two kinds. One is conventional pollutants, and this really has to do with the way the plant is operated. It's a way of assessing how well the plant is operating. We also call these limits technology-based limits, and they include things like biochemical oxygen demand, total suspended solids, oil and grease, pH, chlorine residual, and bacteria. These limits are the same as in the last permit, the previous permit, and they're also very similar to other treatment plants in the Bay Area. Compliance is fully expected with these limits, just to say also that a big part of the permit renewal process is to negotiate limits that CMSA can meet and can comply with. The second type of effluent limits are toxic pollutants, and these are have to do with the protection of aquatic life and human health. And they are also known as water quality-based effluent limits and are calculated to the specific conditions for CMSA. There's a wide range of constituents that CMSA could have effluent limits for, but CMSA only has limits for four, which is really good. It's on the low end of the scale. And that includes copper, cyanide, dioxin, TEQ, which is a factor incorporating 17 congeners of different kinds of dioxin, but it's just one number that is generated from that. And then also total ammonia. And ammonia can be thought of either in a toxic context. If you ever had a fish tank, you know ammonia could be a potential issue for your fish. But it's also a constituent in a nutrient context, which is different. That's not what we're talking about here. It's just toxic.
Yeah, Michael, like three or four permits ago, we had a much more expanded list of the toxic pollutants, right? Like
yes.
Silver and mercury and copper, things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So these are the same constituents as in the most recent permit. The numeric limits in this permit are slightly different. They're just off by 1 or 2 micrograms per liter.
Are they higher?
No, lower.
So
they never go up. They only go down.
More stringent.
Right. They only get more stringent. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, do we know the sources of these, the primary sources?
Yes. The source of copper could be copper plumbing mm-hmm. in a home. Sometimes copper can be in other things, like sometimes manufacturers get creative and they like to put copper in clothing because they call it a disinfectant, and so then that copper could be released in the wash or something like that. Cyanide is actually a limit because believe it or not, the way we measure cyanide is an artifact of the chlorination process. So it's not actually generated within your service area.
Okay.
It's actually an artifact of the chlorination process.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And what about dioxin TEQ?
Dioxin is a legacy pollutant, and so... And it's of concern mostly because San Francisco Bay is listed as impaired mm-hmm. for this particular constituent, and so it's sort of a protective mechanism.
Do we see any of that coming into the plan?
None that is quantified.
Okay.
Occasionally there'll be a value that's estimated that is detected as present, but there's not enough to actually say how much.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Sure. And then ammonia, of course, is
we know that.
Yeah, know about ammonia. Okay. So also with these toxic pollutants, compliance is expected. So another important part of the permit is our requirements related to blending. And just as a little bit of background, prior to 2005, blending was commonplace in the U.S. and had no special status at all. Many plants in the U.S. Are designed to blend, including CMSA, and right when CMSA started the plant, it was built to blend with the concurrence of US EPA and myriad state agencies. In December 2005, EPA kind of changed their mind about how to handle blending, and they issued a draft blending policy based on a negotiated approach between the stakeholders of the wastewater treatment plants and EPA, the federal agency. However, the final rule was never promulgated because of the controversy. But EPA Region 9, which is our local regional office of EPA, and the Regional Water Board in Oakland are still using the draft blending policy to write permits. We have not contested it prior to this because the requirements have always been reasonable. As part of this 2005 initiative, blending is now being classified as a bypass. It's a brand new interpretation of bypass. And bypasses trigger special requirements. So there are requirements in the permit related to blending. Probably the most significant ones are for the collection agencies, and as Jason mentioned, what's new about this permit is that the collection agencies are listed as co-permittees. That is the three large agencies, Ross Valley, SRSD, and Corte Madera. The smaller San Quentin agencies were deemed to be too small to include. There are significant requirements for rehabilitation and replacement of the sewer lines. The list of projects that are in the permit were provided to the Regional Water Board at the Regional Water Board's request, and as part of the discussion for developing that list, we worked together to make sure that the completion dates were would easily be met by the agencies. There are also two private sewer lateral programs for SRSD and Corte Madera. Ross Valley doesn't have that requirement because they already have a private sewer lateral program. And the private sewer lateral program requirements in the permit are to develop a program and present it to the board, but it doesn't mandate that the board take an action because they don't have the authority to do that, just so you know.
The That's water board doesn't have the authority to. I mean, the district board do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, there are also requirements for CMSA, and that includes replacing the collection system flow meters and reporting on the progress of that replacement, summarizing the effect of new flow meters, also continuing the public notification of blending events. CMSA posts the blending data on the website, and they will continue to do that. Also prepare a no feasible alternatives analysis, also known as a utility analysis, and that will happen with the permit application in about 4 years. And it is specified that this analysis be done according to that old draft blending policy and include a list of future feasible actions for collection agencies to do in the next permit.
Was there a problem with the flow meters?
So we have three requirements. One is to replace the flow meter at the main San Quentin pump station because it was original and it was erratic in terms of readouts. We've done that already. We replaced it and calibrated it, so it's operating now. And then we said we would replace an insertion ultrasonic flow meter on the San Rafael Sanitation District's interceptor that comes in. So we have two flow meters on that. One's a primary, one's a backup. We replaced the primary. So that's been done also. And it said that we would purchase a new flow meter for the Sanitary District number 2 force main right before it ties into the Ross Valley interceptor. So we purchased that, and it said we would coordinate with Ross Valley Sand and Sand 2 for the installation of that. So that's ongoing. They've had some staff changes at Sand District Number 2. You know, I'm aware that their staff will be working with their design consultant to look at, you know, the potential installation of that and other assets within the underground box where the force thing, you know, is located. So that's underway.
Do we not have a flow meter for Sandy 2?
There was one. It was you know, 20. It was installed in 1987, and it was starting to, you know, become not as reliable to the point where we actually had to strap on a portable flow meter and use that for flow monitoring.
Okay, so moving on, other changes to the permit included an influent monitoring requirement for cyanide. This was kind of an add-on because in the previous permit there was a more favorable cyanide effluent limit adopted, and so this was just sort of a catch-up related to that more favorable cyanide effluent limit. And so that came in to this permit. Also, the effluent standard observations were removed. Those standard observations are things like looking at the water and seeing if there's an oily surface or something like that. And there's never been that problem, so those observations were removed. The total suspended solid sampling was reduced from 3 times per week to 2 times per week. And then we also were able to reduce the oil and grease sampling from 4 times per year to 2 times per year, and that's a laboratory analysis. These reductions in sampling are probably have a nominal cost savings, not a lot. Of course, I mentioned that the Regional Water Board hearing happened on January 10th. At that meeting, the Regional Water Board staff gave a presentation on the permit to their board. And there was lots of engagement between the board members and the Regional Water Board staff, as well as engagement between the board members and the commenters, which included CMSA, Ross Valley, SRSD, and USEPA. The whole, this agenda item for them took about 2.5 hours. There was a lot of discussion. The board members acknowledged the additional liability to the collection agencies by becoming co-permittees on this NPDES permit, and what they did to try to help to acknowledge that situation. They made 2 changes to the permit. One was to consolidate requirements related to the deadlines, which made them a little bit more lenient, and then also to allow for if you wanted to replace pipe in a different part of the service area than the one you originally planned for, that would be okay as long as the total pipe length added up to be the same. So the next steps for the permit, now that we have a new permit, is to get ready for implementation of this new permit, to track the next steps of the collection agency permit appeal process, now that appeal would have been submitted, and to continue the good relationship that we held with the Regional Water Board throughout this whole permit renewal process. It was a really good exchange with them, and that's really important since they have enforcement authority over the agency. So this permit renewal process was a team effort, and it included Jason, of course, but also Chris Fenton and Mark Kokomer and myself.
I would put Monica's name up top. She did the most work and the most productive work, I think, and valuable work. We just reviewed a lot of things.
And so that wraps it up. So if you have any other questions, I'm happy to. Okay.
Any questions?
Well, so in essence, we just finished our permit, and you're telling us we got to get ready for the next permit?
It's a continual process. I would like to just say that I feel like this is a really good permit for CMSA. It creates a lot of stability for the agency over the next 5 years without, you know, any uncertainty. So,
well, I had a question.
Yes.
Would you be so kind as to go back to the slide that talked about what CMSA has to do in 4 years, taking into consideration the draft from 2005. No, I think forward.
It was right at the end.
I think it's the next one. Yes, the no feasible alternatives analysis according to the draft blending policy. That worries me a little bit. So what might we see there?
Sure. So we have prepared this no feasible alternatives analysis for the 2007 permit, the 2012 permit, and now the 2018 permit. Mm-hmm. And what the analysis consists of is it's mainly a reporting on what has been happening during the previous 5 years and a list of what the agency, or in this case, the collection systems, can do in the future to continue to reduce blending. So, for example, we talked about all the data associated with the blending events, the number of events, the volume of events. We talked about the, a lot of it is going to be repeat information from what we've talked about before, how CMSA works with the satellite agencies, that they are separate government agencies, some basic information like that.
Okay, but specifically regarding having to do this in 4 years, taking into consideration that draft blending policy, does that really change anything for that analysis?
The only thing that will be different about it, really, in the past, is that now there will be collection agency projects listed specifically for the future.
Okay.
That's the only thing that will be different from past utility analyses.
Got it. Okay.
The biggest area within the utility analysis is the no feasible alternative blending, alternatives. And that's where we scope out all the different, storage alternatives and treatment alternatives with descriptions and conceptual costs. And that piece of the utility analysis, we brought to the board back in December and winnowed it down to the two where you guys selected the no project alternative, which made its way into the permit.
And we did talk about that in the most recent utility analysis, those alternatives, that selection mm-hmm. process. This time we won't need to do that because it will be focused on the collection agencies.
Yes.
Your project will be requested a little bit more.
So in the future, remember one of the alternatives was $11.6 million to spiff up the clarifier or whatever it was. And but then we chose the no feasibility alternative. But now that's going to be no feasibility for the treatment plant, but it's going to be what the collection agencies are going to do something.
Yes, exactly. Instead of focusing on the treatment plant like we did for this most recent one, there will be less focus on the treatment plant and more focus on the collection agencies.
Is there any liability to the treatment plant if one of the agencies just doesn't do what they're supposed to do?
That's a really good question. The permit is written pretty much such that what the collection agencies are responsible for and what CMSA is responsible for is pretty well spelled out. That said, we did make a comment on the draft permit saying we want it to be more specific. We want those requirements to be what we call severable, which means, if somebody doesn't do something that they're supposed to do, nobody else will be on the hook. We made the comment to have language in there that was very direct about that, but the Regional Water Board opted to not accept that comment and to not put that language in there because it gives them the maximum enforcement authority. It's not in their interest to do that. So whether or not another agency, either CMSA or another collection agency, could be pulled in if your agency, say, didn't do what they were supposed to do, it depends on who's making the decision and what information they use. I'd say there's less than a 50% chance that somebody else would get pulled in. That's my general take, but it's not a guarantee.
So CMSA, with this new permit, and the new additional permittees of the collection agencies,
basically taking on the burden of the no blending requirement. Mm-hmm. We're sort of moving forward altogether. We're sort of off the hook from
ever for CMSA?
Having, yeah, for CMSA, sort of ever having to sort of do anything here at the plant then.
Well, probably for this permit and the next permit, I'd say that's
so
pretty likely.
10 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did we get a fixed, say for Ross Valley, did we get a number of feet of pipeline that we have to replace?
Yes.
And can you remember what it was?
Not off the top of my head, but I have the permit with me.
Is it about a mile?
No.
Well, it was submitted by each agency, right?
Yeah,
it was submitted by us, but I'm wondering, because I think in 5 years, they're going to go to us. It was submitted by us, yeah. We all submitted our own.
I mean, in theory, if we're right, that we should open up our system more. The INI should reduce significantly, and blending will become
If that happens during this permit cycle, we'd definitely report that to the Regional Water Board, and hopefully they would receive that well, minimize the requirements in the next permit. We'll have to see what happens. But I'll keep you guys based on what we measure here in terms of reductions.
Blending only happens during the significant rain events.
During the rain events, and then after the rain events also, when the groundwaters are raised by the major storms, and when that happens, you could have very small rain events, and you have pretty large flow increases, not peaks, but greater than the capacity of the secondary system.
Any other questions?
You can have that if you want.
A little light reading.
I like our part only. You can keep this. I'll get just our part.
Okay. And I'm happy to send you just that part.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
Okay.
That's it.
Thank you. Would you mind? In fact, I would love a copy of that, too.
Okay.
Is there a link to...
I can send it to all the board members if you want a copy of the adopted permit.
Yeah. And email it to us, and then we can... out what we want.
The whole permit, yeah.
If it's too large to...
I'll send it tonight so you can go to bed nice and early when you read it.
It's probably like 5 megabytes. It's very okay. Emailable. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Monica.
Sure.
This was informational only, correct? Jason, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you. Moving on. Agenda item 7, proposed 5-year... revenue plan discussion. Okay. Provide direction.
So at the last board meeting on January 10th, the Finance Committee presented the culmination of a lot of good work over the fall, which was their preliminary revenue plan. And that's shown on page 1 of the staff report. And what's shown here is just the high-level summary of the EDU rate increase and what the EDU rate changes each year. You see the rate increase fluctuates. And this preliminary plan, it aligned with the guiding principles that were established by the committee. So what we did is we presented the guiding principles. The board thought those looked really good, and you accepted those. And then a discussion of the preliminary, 5-year rate increase was a revenue plan. You said a couple things. One, let's try to develop an alternative where you have the annual increase to be approximately equal or smooth. And let's do that for two different debt issuance terms, a 20-year term and a 25-year term, because what we showed the board was a debt issuance over a 30-year term. And the reason we were talking about the 20 and 25-year term, because that's more likely the lifespan of the major infrastructure assets that would be replaced for the debt issuance, with the debt issuance proceeds. So staff and the committee, met after the board meeting, and we prepared what's in this handout. There was, one discussion where we constructed one alternative, and then we had some subsequent, kind of a phone conversation, in-person meetings with individuals, and we constructed what's on the plan here. So what we have before the board is some revisions to the guiding principles. So those are shown in red, and a slight reorganization of the principles so they kind of flow in a way that makes a little more sense. So the committee's proposing that the board accept these. And then the second aspect would be, if those are accepted, to then direct staff to integrate those guiding principles into a financial policy. And then the third, you know, recommendation is to discuss these three alternatives on the handouts and hopefully select one to move forward with the next five-year revenue plan. So do you want to start with the guiding principles?
Yes.
Okay. So good discussion by the committee. They made the revisions, reorganized it, and we think that they look pretty good. Any other comments on the principles?
No.
So we're talking about this first section in the revised sheet that you got at your place. So, okay. Everybody good with that? Any member of the public like to comment on this?
Could I have one little comment?
Absolutely.
So I think the key change is that we're trying to use pay-as-you-go financing first. And then we put in secure low-interest SRF loans because, remember, Jason secured one and even got a grant. So that's a terrific deal.
Free money's a good...
And then, you know, the last is to issue debt. That's our last choice, quite frankly. You know? And so we added a few things like that. So I think when we do this again in 5 years, you go to the guiding principles and kind of try to do the same thing again.
Yeah, it's our kind of policy direction of the board. That's a starting point to develop the next revenue plan.
Can we approve these tonight? It says provide. That would be good. We could approve them, right?
Sure.
Is that right?
I believe so.
Yeah. It says provide guidance, but I guess guidance is approving them.
Yeah, that's the staff recommendation. You could take any action on.
I mean, the second item was to ask staff to incorporate these into the debt policy. So maybe you could take a look at the. I mean, we have a
section. Yeah, I identified a policy, and that's actually in the staff report. Yeah. And it's a financial planning policy associated with debt financing management. Mm-hmm. So we'd create a new section in there with an explanation of what we're showing, and we would, if these were accepted, we would just insert those into that particular financial planning policy.
And you know you have to have a debt policy now if you issue bonds. It's a new requirement, so this covers it.
So rather than just adopting this, I say we let Jason take this back and clean up what we've got and get it all organized and bring it back.
Yeah, bring it, why don't you, so well, bring it back.
Well, how about you guys accept it so we can get it in the recommendation?
Yeah, let's just stick to the recommendation.
Language. Right. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
The reasonable extent possible for PAYGO for the capital improvements. What percentage are you envisioning?
Well, to the extent possible. And what I, you know, think about, we're in municipal. They got highly criticized because they were trying to switch to pay-as-you-go from debt financing. So I think what I'm looking for is that if we can keep the rate increases below 4%, that kind of limits how much pay-as-you-go we can do, rather than taking a percentage. But the five-year plan, and in fact the extension to 10 years, it's if we fund the whole CIP program, $46 million, 27 of it would be pay-as-you-go, and 19 would be bonds. So that's a huge amount of pay-as-you-go.
And is that ratio common?
It is when you have a huge capital improvement program. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be half fund or more. And some agencies fund the whole thing with it. But we have a lot of smaller projects, and so I think it's germane that we do those pay-as-you-go. Mm-hmm. I don't think the rules are percent of your expenses that are used for debt. Mm-hmm. And I've been to the rating agency. They get worried when over 40% of your expenses are for debt.
I would be too.
Yeah.
That's high.
That's high, but you know, we're capital intensive.
Yeah,
that's not
surprising to me.
It's a lot higher than we are.
What percentage is ours? What percent of our expenses? Well, I mean, those bonds are.
I don't have the calculation.
Maybe I do. Yeah, the debt service right now, I think, is $3.8 million. Mm-hmm. If you look at our total expenses, operating, capital, and debt. Think about this for a minute. Oh, you want? Good thing I'm doing the budget all the time.
It would be if we issued the second bond, it would be about $5 million out of $20 million. So it would be 0.5%. That's if we issued the second bond.
And if we issued it for this amount.
So if you look at like this year, our funding requirements in the budget summarized is $19.7 million. If you look at the debt services, that includes coverage. So I'm assuming we'd remove the coverage from that, Tom, when we do sure. that ratio. Yeah. Take the coverage out, it's, you know, well, that's not included coverage, excuse me. So that's four of 20. So
20%. That's 20%.
Yeah. So 20%.
Yeah, 20%.
That strikes me as low. Because we should be striving for some sort of a balance between, because current ratepayers shouldn't be paying for capital projects that have a lifespan, in some cases, of decades.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we don't want to be so heavily in debt, so we need to find a balance. It sounds like we've focused more on the pay-as-you-go, which is going to tend to create higher rates now.
Yes. It does. I mean, if we wanted to go to a full pay-as-you-go program, we'd probably be 5 or 6% increases over the next 5 years. And
we did that analysis just for the 5-year revenue plan. If we weren't going to issue any debt, we'd have to bring in, you know, it was going to be $1 million increase each year, and it was, you know, oh, I think it was pretty close.
I can't remember.
9%. It was pretty high.
Right. It's kind of an extreme position to be in, to have this much pay as you go. For a capital intensive industry at a time when debt is so inexpensive.
Yeah. Here's what I think. Most of our CIP is replacements. Mm-hmm. And you could argue that replacements should be paid on a pay as you go basis. You can. You know, even the IRS doesn't know how to quite handle replacements in terms of depreciation and everything. But so we got a lot of replacements and we got some upgrades. And I think I would rather focus on the rate increase. I think that's where the action is for us. Let's see, if we issued a lot of debt, we could knock the rate increase down to, you know, well, first of all, O&M is going up 3.5% a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the calculation of what, wasn't it? 3.5% for the operation and maintenance. Yeah.
Which is about CPI, so that's
You know, that's over $10 million this year.
But that's not capital.
That's about 3.5%.
Right, that doesn't leave us much for capital.
So what we're thinking is, you know, we have a debt issuance, and that's a whole separate discussion that we'd have probably in a year and a half. So I suggest, you know, when we get together the finance committee and look at doing that, what we bundle into it, we can bring some options back to the board then, so we could have a smaller issuance, which means more PAYGO funding, or we could bring more projects into it. Mm-hmm. Then we envision here any of these alternatives, which then, if we kept that rate, then we'd have more money for a bigger debt issuance also. Mm-hmm. Because less would be used for the PAYGO piece. Mm-hmm. So then you're spreading those out over a longer period of time. So the money would go farther.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think... I think if we can pay with reasonable rate increases, I think we should do that. And I think 3.5% is reasonable. Mm-hmm. And if we want to use more pay-as-you-go, we've got to raise that rate.
I think when the time comes, it would be good to see what we're looking at in terms of the capital investments. How much of it are these small replacements that you're anticipating will probably be pay-as-you-go? And which ones are the big ticket items? And take a look at what the lifespan is, because if every year we have replacements of, say, $3 million or whatever, but it's $3 million kind of every year ongoing, that evens it out, and I don't worry so much about the argument that Mary Beth made about the current ratepayers having to pay for an asset that will benefit ratepayers, you know, for many decades to come. So it might be interesting to take a look and try to see if there's some kind of sweet spot where we can kind of say, okay, the goal would be to have this pay go and this not. And I don't know if it's the nature of the asset, the cost, the lifespan, or some combination of all three.
So right now, for these debt issuances, we've just bundled in the projects that have a long lifespan.
Yeah.
RCIP has a lot of different pieces to it. We designed it this way, you know, intentionally. Years ago, we had a lot of extra bond proceeds that we had to use. So we have a lot of what some agencies would consider just repair and replacement activities or asset management activities, which some agencies wouldn't include in capital. Capital's mm-hmm. bigger projects. So we have some bigger projects. Then we have a lot of asset management. Then we have things even like lighting system replacements, small pump and sampler replacement, lab equipment, things that don't last 5-10 years, sometimes even shorter lifespan, depending on the environment. And those are things that we've kind of focused more pay-go. So those aren't included in the debt issuance. These are just the bigger projects, mm-hmm. bigger dollar amounts, and also smaller dollar amounts as compared to some, but longer lifespan assets. We want to pay for more the lifespan.
What we did last time, remember, that was your comment, Chairman Moon, was to take a look at going, you know, the first recommendation was 30 years, and then we redid it down to 25, and then we looked at 20-year financing, because mm-hmm. a lot of these projects aren't long-term. I think a reasonable way to look at it is what, you know what's going to happen? We're going to do this 10-year $46 million, and in 10 years, we're going to have another $50 million worth of projects. And so just bonding all these things, we pay the interest, and you don't lower the rates. And really, basically, nobody benefits from just funding everything with interest. Also, as I tell our committee, and we don't do it, you know, our board, I would like to get us to pay as you go, 100%. Because we're going to have these projects every single year. And if we are pay as you go, we eliminate the interest cost.
Well, you do, but you need to create sinking funds then and plan on
it. We don't have any opportunity. We've got a reserve, but if you're spending money every single year, you're not going to create a sinking fund. You're keeping up with it.
Keith, did you have?
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, a couple of the big capital intensive projects, because we, on the Finance Committee, I commented last meeting that we did vet the CIP pretty extensively and had Jason and his staff even rank projects as to which ones were critical, which ones needed to get done, which ones were on course with decisions that were made before I was on this board, such as bringing a second generator online and to enhance our reliability of the biogas generation system and stuff. So we've made some decisions on the board to invest in that. So that's a big ticket item. It's on the order of like $3 million or so to bring that thing online, Jason.
I think we have in the budget, you know, probably, you know, 5 to 6, you
five
know,
six.
For, you know, the, you know, planning,
mm-hmm. planning,
design, construction. And construction, yeah.
Yeah. And then, there's the secondary system
we have
improvements
that
are
modifications to the secondary systems.
And so these are big systems that we've made decisions on that are big ticket items that you can't ask, you know, the current ratepayers just to fund that. I mean, that's a big, long capital investment, as well as the secondary. I mean, that's a big, you know, 50-year lifespan, so you got to invest in that now, bring it up to snuff, and then you pay for it over the life. So on the committee, we did do, I think, a bang-up job sort of vetting all that out and trying to anticipate these questions and I think bring this option, which I think is pretty solid. I didn't want to see it above 3%, but this is the best we can do when we sort of move things around and with Tom's good financing look at it, he actually came up with some of this and had Ken vet it out and stuff, and everything, you know, in my mind looks pretty darn good on this. But it's just a couple of those really big projects that we can't do a pay-as-you-go, otherwise we'd have an astronomical rate increase.
Yeah, and it'd be, you know, cyclical. You'd have a huge rate increase, you have small rate increases, then a big one, then you drop off.
Right. So this is smooth, isn't it?
The agencies.
Yeah.
You know, because then we're asking, you know, 1 year for our constituents to do one thing and the next year to do another. And this way we get to flatten our rate increases at the other end.
So Mary Beth, on that guiding principle that you brought up, like leading the discussion to the reasonable extent possible, is that framed okay, just kind of general like that? Or just future direction to the staff and the finance committee?
To the reasonable extent possible, I mean, kind of conflated a couple of concepts. You know, is it possible? Is it reasonable? Aren't we looking for balancing PAYGO with financing, preferring PAYGO for short-term projects?
You see, what are we going to do when we issue debt in 3 years and 6 years or whatever it is? We're going to look at the projects. Think, what do we need to fund? You know, we're not making a decision now. And, you know, if you issue debt, some of the debt comes due in 1 year. So we can have a series of projects that we're funding. You know, if some of the debt comes due in 5 years, we tie that to a 5-year project, and so on. I know that on the CIP, we had the consultants, some of it is Carollo that did it. That got vetted through the staff, mm-hmm. And I think you added some projects and took some off. Probably took more off than we're adding.
We ended up adding about $9 million in projects, and then there was I forget the number, maybe a few million dollars of projects that they were recommending that were already incorporated in the CIP. Mm-hmm. So we pulled those off what they were recommending.
Yeah. And indeed, and tried to look at timing some of the projects, and it had really already been reviewed really carefully by staff. And we, as a finance committee, did not want to postpone projects. We wanted to do some every year, you know, not push them off. And so we've got that. Our CIP, you know, you saw the CIP sheet. It's this one. I don't know, 70 projects on it, if you count every year, you know, or more, I don't know.
I mean, this plan fully funds in the time frame that staff recommended every project. The likelihood of when we get to that place that we're on schedule to do all those things, I've heard numbers of like usually it's around 70%, and maybe we don't have to, when we get to that point 6 years from now, we don't have to issue that much of a debt issuance. It may not have to do that 5 years from now or whenever the first one is. It may be less of a debt issuance and keep the numbers down and then more pay as you go.
Right. And I'm seeing Mary Beth writing some stuff down, so I'm guessing you're wordsmithing over there.
I'm building on Dan's words. How about this? When feasible, comma, use current revenues to fund CIP projects.
Okay, say it again. When feasible?
When feasible, use current revenues to fund CIP projects. I had reserves in there, too, but that sounds like we're going to drain our reserves. That's not what we want to say. We want to say current revenues. Right?
About how about current capital revenues? Because we distinguish operating revenues from capital.
Where feasible?
What's a capital revenue?
We have a separate capital fee that's part of our regional charge. So it's a capital fee. So it's any excess operating charges.
I like that.
Where and unrestricted capital reserves that we use.
I'm trying to say capital revenues. Because we use O&M revenues if they're over. What was it we were going to talk about?
When feasible, comma, use current revenues to fund CIP projects.
I'm happy with that.
Would it be worthwhile to add something referencing the fact that we're trying to balance PAYGO with maybe longer-term financing for the really big-ticket items?
Well, that's the notion of feasibility. When is it feasible?
Well, it just might be desirable if, let's say, we have some reserve funds, reserve capital funds, I shouldn't use reserve, capital revenues available, we're undertaking a big ticket project.
Well, why don't we add that to the next one? Secure low interstate revolving funds or issue debt to fund longer term CIP projects.
But we could use state revolving funds.
Why handcuff ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole idea is here, you're saying, is when all things are equal, we'll go this way.
We all want to use CIP, the current fund, the extent possible where feasible. How do we all agree on that? And I'm happy with where feasible, comma, use current revenues to fund the CIP, to fund CIP projects.
Sure.
Okay. Capital improvement program.
Okay, so we'll replace that principle with
when
feasible principle.
That's what we intended.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay.
So with that, would you guys want to accept the principles?
I accept the principles.
Okay, any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none, okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That's with that.
With that change. Any opposed? Okay, that was unanimous. Direction to staff, do we want to have Jason incorporate this into...
And incorporate it into
debt policy.
A debt policy. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Anybody opposed to that? Any member of the public like to speak? Okay. Jason, you got that?
So that's direction, yes.
All right.
I'll bring it back next month.
Select a revenue plan option.
So there's three options, and the first two build on the preliminary plan, which had it was one debt issuance in, say, fiscal year 20 for a 30-year term. And it was about $15 million in debt. So when the board said, okay, let's take a look at that, let's smooth it, and look at 25 and 25-year terms. So to smooth the rate and to reduce it, we had to have a bigger debt issuance. So that's what we ended up with, $17 million. So one and two have $17 million issuance, a single issuance, 25-year term on number one, 20-year term on number two. So you see what the percent increases are. Then the third option is a little bigger issuance of $19 million. It has a 20-year term. It has two debt issuances, one in fiscal year 20, which could be, you know, $9, $10, $11 million, then one in 23 at the end, which could be the balance. And the thing to note on this one is that after this five-year planning period, there would likely need to be, you know, some form of a revenue increase to cover the debt service portion of the debt service for that second issuance in FY23. So those are the three options for the board to consider, and community members can...
Well, I think if we put zero down, if at the end of year fiscal 23, we put zero rate increase, we'd go in the hole fairly fast, no matter what.
Yeah, we'd use our reserves operating
so
and...
So all of these alternatives are going to have a rate increase, we're going to be doing rate increases forever, some at some level. A utility district that doesn't raise their rates a little bit for 1 year gets murdered the next year, and nobody appreciates the fact that the rates didn't increase the last year. You know, the nominal rate increase each year is, I think, we're going to be stuck with. But
Tom, didn't you mention like central Contra Costa Water? They have like an automatic 3.5 every year.
Does 3.75% a year. Every year they've got a big capital program, and they have the lowest water rates around. Because they fund it each year, they don't miss a year. Now, here's what I like about two debt issuances. If we go to one debt issuance, and by the way, we're going to decide that in the future anyway, then what happens is you issue bonds at 3.6 or 7 or 5, whatever it is, and you know, things being equal, and you earn 1%. And so if you issue debt, a big debt issue, and it takes you years to spend it, you're losing 2.5% a year on the balance in your debt, you know, the project account that you've funded. And so it's kind of a loser to issue a lot of debt and then not spend it right away. And so, and by the way, I don't think we're issuing a lot even at 19, but you know, I think it's set up to do it in two issues, and the issuance costs about $200,000. And 1 year interest differential on $10 million is $250,000. You know, the loss. So if you can delay it for 2 or 3 years, you're ahead $500,000. And my guess is we'll probably fund 70% of the, we'll probably not be able to do. Jason's got a huge CIP list here, and it's going to be difficult to do.
So it's closer to the page about principal.
Then we wouldn't issue as much debt in the second issue. It's my prediction, which probably will be wrong. But anyway,
so option three gives us more flexibility.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does actually.
Okay.
Just in time.
So is that making a proposal for option three?
Yeah.
I'm in favor of option three, but I'm willing to listen to.
I agree. The other benefit is it applies to the first bullet, is that we look after in FY20, we then look at the CIP, sort of adjust. We didn't get this much work done. Okay, well then we can adjust our projection as well for how much we're going to need in the second bond issuance and stuff.
Yeah. So, or we issue a little bit more of the first issue. You know, we're going to look at it in 3 years.
So, makes sense to me.
So this five-year look ahead, each time we issue a bond, it applies very nicely to this scenario for option three. And it's also the lowest rate increase.
Okay. Mary Beth, option three?
Sounds great.
Michael?
I move we recommend option three.
Second.
Any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
I believe that was unanimous.
Thank you very much.
That's good. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Really good analysis. Thank you.
And I'll report it to the
JP. Well, we had a great finance committee, and that was the staff.
Okay, moving on. Agenda item 8, administrative policy number 68, employee compensation and benefit approval process.
Thank you, Chair. First, so at the last meeting, we talked about the possibility of having a two-step, you know, approval process for employee compensation and benefits, you know, increases. And we had a pretty good discussion about that and looked at some different options. We need to have a one-step versus a two-step. And really the direction from the board was let's craft a policy that uses a two-step process, but it's flexible to where the general manager's recommendation approved by the board, you can have a one-step process. So I took the direction from the board and I incorporated into this administrative policy number 68. Last month we talked about incorporating into a single personnel policy, but reviewing the personnel policy manual, there's several policies on the different benefits and compensation administration, so we thought it would be a little cleaner just to incorporate, you know, the process into a single policy for easy reference. So that's what's before the board, attached to the staff report. So you have a policy statement, and you have the procedures. The first one says, you know, anything's approved by the board at a public meeting in accordance with the Brown Act. It's obvious. Second is the two-step process, the procedures for that. Then kind of an explanation of when we'd have a one-step process. Then the statement saying that, you know, normally we're not going to make any adjustments at a special meeting or emergency meeting just because of the reduced time, you know, that for noticing and advertising of the meeting. However, something may occur where it has to be done, so that gives us the flexibility to do it. So with that, I could answer any questions if you have any, or receive any direction on any changes you might want to see.
I just wanted to add, the whole reason behind this is to increase transparency. There has been some comments floating around about other agencies by certain watchdog organizations that like to see a little more transparency regarding compensation and benefit issues. So that's what this is about. Any questions or comments?
So this is just about the way you do it at the city?
Well, we adopted many of these, yeah. Because a lot of people say, oh, well, I never saw that agenda item, and oh, you're trying to hide things and not let the public know. You stretch it out over two meetings, that gives the public plenty of opportunity. But we're talking about the big adjustments, you know, labor group contracts, maybe a whole new job classification with a new salary range, something like that. If it's just one little adjustment, you know, that's inconsequential, you know, that can be done in one meeting. More transparency.
The approach?
Oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense, and we'll make sure we follow it.
Any member of the public like to speak to this? If there aren't any objections or changes you want to see, I'd entertain a motion to adopt this new policy.
Move we approve administrative policy number 68.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So that's unanimous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Agenda item 9, San Francisco Bay Nutrient Watershed Permit Status Report.
So there's a lot of information, you know, attached to the staff report. But I'll make a really brief presentation and the staff recommendation. And you ask any questions if you have any about the first watershed permit and the second. But in summary, so there is a nutrient watershed permit that was adopted for the Bay Area in 2014. It's applicable to all 37 wastewater discharges in the Bay Area. And it has several requirements in it. And back before it was adopted, the CMSA board approved CMSA participating in the permit through BACWA, the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, primarily because it shows that you're working together in a group, which is great, a lot of collaboration, and you have the economies of scales for all the different, you know, wastewater, you know, all the monitoring and sampling and all the different studies that are done at each of the wastewater agencies to determine how they can remove nutrients at a conceptual level. So BACWA's been doing a fine job, you know, representing all the dischargers, and administering, managing, you know, the consulting contract for the technical evaluations and also the science plan through the San Francisco Estuary Institute for all the bay monitoring analyses. So now the second watershed permit is being talked about, and that will likely be adopted by the Regional Water Board in April of 2019. So BACWA has been, you know, discussing with its members. The members from, you know, have a representative from each sub-embayment of the bay, which sit on a committee. And they work with the BACWA board on, you know, various aspects of the first permit and then discussions of how to develop a plan of study for the second permit. And originally, the Regional Water Board was hoping to get enough information from the science plan and a nutrient management strategy from the first permit to then determine which areas of the bay are impaired by nutrients. And that's ammonia and nitrogen compounds and phosphorus. And then which agencies contribute to that, and which would need some type of effluent limit to reduce the nutrient loading to the bay. But as we move through the first, you know, permit, you know, we realized, and most importantly, the Regional Water Board, that the science funding was underfunded, and they just don't have enough data to set, you know, load caps by agency or effluent limits based on the science that's been developed. So BACWA, with this, you know, committee, proposed to the Regional Water Board, instead of setting load caps or effluent limits, how about we just invest more money into a continued science plan, while wastewater agencies are continue to monitor for the nutrients and reporting that out through BACWA and the Regional Water Board. And then over the next 5 years, that's 19 through 23, you'd have enough data then to look at, you know, what parts of the bay are impaired, what agencies contribute, and what should their effluent limits be. So the Regional Water Board has bought into that plan. And so staff's recommendation is for the second watershed permit, authorized us to participate through BACWA and to provide the funding for our share of the nutrient surcharge for the work. And our funding contribution would increase from, that's in this table here that's attached, from $15,000 to $32,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So that'd be an add-on to our BACWA membership fee for the nutrient watershed permit surcharge. I think it's a very economical and collaborative way to do it versus CMSA having decided to opt out of working with BACWA and having to do these things on our own by hiring like SEFEI ourselves to do this.
They've doubled their budget?
Pardon me?
They've more than doubled their budget?
That was the regional water. I mean, there's a lot of discussions that I'm not familiar with between the SEFEI and information they gave to the BACWA estimating what we need to do to get enough, you know, sampling analysis to fully develop the science plan to incorporate into the nutrient management strategy. So that was all determined. And the Regional Water Board said, well, we'd like to see 2.5 times the current funding level for the science plan, and also an additional enhancement for the next 2 fiscal years. This was last year. So this fiscal year, next fiscal year. And BACWA, as an organization, said they would cover that additional funding for the science plan themselves, not go back to the membership for those 2 fiscal years.
And what do we pay BACWA other than this?
Pardon me?
Don't we pay them annual fee as well?
Yeah, we pay them an annual membership fee. And then, so there's an membership fee, there's an nutrient surcharge, there's the BACWA, you know, education, you know, fee. And there's also the regional monitoring program fee. So that way, BACWA, through also SCFI, they do all the regional monitoring for various pollutants instead of CMSA doing it by ourselves.
Right. What's their like administrative budget? How much do we pay them for their administrative side?
I'd have to look at their invoice, annual invoice, but I could tell you what the total is that we pay BACWA.
Okay.
Which, just taking a second here, because I think there's 2 different accounts that things are bundled into. So for the BACWA education piece, that's $8,000. So that's a piece of it. Mm-hmm. Then there's the BACWA membership, which is $8,000. Then we would have the nutrient surcharge, and that's in a different.
$15,500 according to this table.
$15,500. Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'm just looking at the
$15,500
in the budget here.
Okay, so these are small amounts. That's per year.
Yeah.
Okay.
If we were doing that program, we'd spend double or triple
the total
budget, and it's much better. But you know what the scary part is? Nutrient removal is nitrification, denitrification, and that's millions of dollars for us. Millions.
So million. Another part of the BACWA fee, so we have the membership fee, we have the BACWA piece, then we have the Clean Bay Collaborative. That's $25,000. And that's for all the regional monitoring. Then we have the surcharge, the nutrient surcharge, which is applicable to activities for the watershed permit. So that's added on to all those other numbers.
Mm-hmm. So it's about 60 or something.
Yeah, so we'd go up another 15.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
75. Yeah, so that's not chalky. What organization am I remembering that were like spendthrifts and wanted to go do wild stuff? Anyway, that's just me thinking. I'm prepared to agree to this.
Jason, you know, I see our ammonia that we're here. What are our nutrients like? I mean, do we have high nutrients in our effluent?
You know, I'm not familiar with because the nutrient monitoring we do here. So that's those analyses are done. I think they're done monthly. Caltest does that, reports out. Then that information we submit to BACWA. Then BACWA integrates that into the annual report that they submit. And I'm not familiar with what those numbers are. But the only nutrient type of permit limit we have in our current permit is associated with ammonia.
Yeah.
And that's a, we have a
we do, yeah.
120 milligram per liter max day and a 60 milligram per liter monthly average.
And we're in the just 30 or so.
Pardon me?
And our numbers are, we're about 30, whatever it is, milligrams per liter, parts per million.
Oh, you're looking at the process report, right? Yeah. I should look at that instead of just trying to remember. Did I get the numbers right, Tom?
But you know, the nutrients come from like dairies and farms, and they have no, and the POTWs are piddling amounts, and these dairies, the runoff from a dairy that goes into the, it would be 200, I don't know, many, many times that we would discharge. And they're not regulating them, and they're regulating us. Foolish. But I'm glad we're in a regional program doing this. I hope they...
Is this science study looking at that, the urban creeks and the rural creeks that are running into the bay,
right,
and,
yeah,
and sort of analyzing, numerically analyzing that as part of this whole study of the bay?
It's looking at the dischargers. There's a lot of different components to that science plan, and I'm not very familiar with all of them, but just generally they're monitoring turbidity in the bay, they're monitoring phytoplankton concentrations in the bay, nutrient concentrations in different areas of the bay, and then based on all that and other sampling analyses, then they're looking at wastewater discharge, you know, nutrient levels to the bay. And that's what we do every month, and we submit feedback on the annual report. I could be wrong, but I don't think they're looking at non-point source discharge to the bay. I think that'd get very expensive. Mm-hmm. It's easy to just look at, you know, point sources. You know, there's 37 of those.
Sorry.
But I don't know if about the science plan. I haven't looked into that.
But NPDES applies to stormwater, too.
Yes, the stormwater.
So they're permitting it taking place for the other jurisdictions.
Cities.
It looks at what you're talking about, I think. Mm-hmm.
Farm runoff?
Because it's jurisdictionally based, those permits, instead of system based.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, I don't know how much, you know, detailed regulation there is for, like...
Well, for example, Marin County has to get an NPDES permit for its jurisdiction.
Oh, for runoff,
yeah. So it gets fined if
Do you know that they just approved flood drainage type fees to put them with water sewer?
I mean, we're having to build into our budgeting now filtration at every catch basin.
Mm-hmm. And you probably are too.
Yeah,
nothing bigger than a quarter.
Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate to make a motion?
I have a quick question, then we'll ask public comment. This nutrient permit is a 5-year permit. Is there any talk about extending the next one beyond 5 years?
No, it's pretty much a 5-year permit term.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're authorized to be in the Clean Water Act is a 5-year permit.
Okay.
How
unless
do they base our fee?
It's extended by the U.S. EPA,
right,
in Congress.
Okay.
How do they do our fee, Jason? Is it by flow or something?
I think it had to do. We received a 13267 letter from the Regional Water Board, which is a section of the Water Code that authorizes them to require discharge to do various monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
We received all wastewater discharge received one of those, you know, back in like maybe 2010-11. And that required us to start monitoring for the different nutrients. So we monitored for a few years, provided information, and I think that the cost allocation was based on your nutrient loading to the bay.
There's a footnote here. It's based on 3 most recent years of discharge of total nitrogen.
Okay.
Total nitrogen.
Kevin Nunes, you've got to read the footnotes.
Mm-hmm. It will make them in a bigger font.
Okay, any other questions? Any member of the public like to speak to this? Okay, Was somebody ready to make a motion?
I am. I move that we approve the agency participation through BACWA on the second SFA nutrient watershed permit.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It's unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have a choice.
No, you don't have a choice, so thank you. All right, North Bay Watershed Association report. I attended the last meeting. And I wanted to thank somebody, one of you, for putting out here a notice about the North Bay Watershed Association annual conference. It will be held on April 6th at the Sheraton Sonoma County. Evidently, it sells out, so if you want to register, go for it. There is a fee.
I believe that members' agencies get a ticket or two.
Only for sponsors.
I checked with Judy Kelly on that, and she said that members don't get free tickets.
Unless
you're a sponsor. So like CMSA is a sponsor. And we bring our public education booth materials there, and our quizzes. And with that, we receive three tickets.
Now, the staff working the booth, they get in.
Yeah, but they're not in the conference. They're sitting in the reception area.
Okay. So I'm planning on attending.
Is somebody that three board can use?
Well, it's for me and the chair.
Sure.
And then before I invite Kate to come. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything on fire or flooding in this picture?
If you're interested in going, you could let me know and we could register you.
Ambiguously.
So it looks like what comes your typical spa weekend in Napa? Oh shit!
Yeah, I think it looks ambiguously ominous. All right, so that was one item that we had discussed at the North Bay Watershed Association meeting of February 2nd, Groundhog Day.
It is a really, really, really interesting, at least it was 2 years ago. It was a very, very good conference and very, very interesting.
Yeah, and those numbers are not pleasant.
The executive director, Judy Kelly, mentioned that the first tranche of Measure A projects, this is the Bay Area-wide, Bay-related, Health, I forget what they called it, but you know what, Measure A, they're due to be announced soon, which projects will be funded.
That was like $12 parcel charge.
Something like that. It was pretty minimal, yeah. Let's see, other notes. Chris Chu from the County Department of Public Works came to speak. She spoke primarily, the topic was Marin County's sea level rise adaptation planning. The bulk of her talk was about the vulnerability assessment that the county has done for all of the communities along the bay. There was a separate vulnerability assessment that was done on the Pacific Ocean side. But she talked about the vulnerability assessment, and then she also talked about resilient by design. So I'll get to that in a second. So the vulnerability assessment looked at lots of different ways in which our bayside communities were vulnerable, everything from personal real estate to transportation, to other infrastructure like, sewer lines. Facilities, businesses, first response, things like that. She said now the county is starting to look at resiliency, mitigation, and reducing greenhouse gases. So there will be an effort, evidently soon, by the county to get the representatives from each of the individual cities in the county back, and we'll start talking about kind of mitigation and resiliency. For what it's worth, I actually represent Corte Madera on the Bay Wave Sea Level Rise Committee. The Resilient by Design was modeled after a project that was done in New York after Hurricane Sandy, I guess it was. Wasn't that the big one in New York? But this was a smaller version of it. It was funded by Rockefeller Foundation to the tune of $4.5 million. And the idea was to get groups of just world-class designers and engineers and forward thinkers to attack various problems in the Bay Area. So communities, you know, submitted their sites, and the design teams took a look, and each design team was paired up with a site. There's one site in each of the counties. In Marin, it's the canal, but also Highway 37. So there will be more on that in the coming couple of months. I think the project is due to end, this Resilient by Design. It's supposed to end mid-May. So we should have some fantastic ideas for the canal. They might be a little too fantastic. They talked about things like undergrounding 101, you know, and creating a waterway, and yeah. So might be things that there's no way on earth we could ever actually do. But we'll see.
Like bingo.
Do they have any Dutch people doing it there?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
They're from all.
Yeah.
I
saw them in Belvedere. Yeah. Oh. What they were encouraging was
Dutch.
Oh, cities built under them.
So Chris talked a little bit about sea level rise funding opportunities. When I say she talked a little bit, she talked a little bit because there isn't a whole lot of funding. But here are a couple of options. SB1, which was the transportation primarily, I believe. They have a little bit of money for sustainable communities and adaptation planning. Round 2 is due February 23rd for up to $1 million per project, which is not going to fund undergrounding 101. Measure AA, which is that's the one I was talking about, the San Francisco Bay Restoration. They give up to $20 million per year for 20 years, but that's for the entire 9-county Bay Area, so those funds go pretty quickly. The Marin Community Foundation is evidently again beginning to fund environmental projects. So they and SCC, which is the Sonoma County Conservation something, I think. Anyway, they're looking at nature-based adaptation. There is a round 2 that will in Marin that is to be announced this spring for $750,000. So not a lot of money for sea level rise funding. Let's see, Point Blue, which is that a Point Reyes? It used to be the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. They are working with the San Francisco Estuary Institute on an adaptation framework, which I'm kind of excited to learn more about that. The idea is to develop adaptation criteria based on the landscape. So they're going to take kind of a mapping and apply these criteria to kind of come up with ways that adaptations can be applied to various locations. So we'll learn more about that. Let's see. Paul Jensen from San Rafael said that the city of San Rafael had two projects that used the CEQA exemption for restoration, and they got the environmental organizations on board. I think this was in response to a question about BCDC and some of the other environmental organizations that tend to, or agencies, that tend to put up a lot of roadblocks, especially when cities are trying to deal with sea level rise, or agencies, presumably. So one of the tricks might be to categorize them as restoration.
BCDC is looking at all these same programs.
Yep.
Resilient by Design, et cetera.
And BCDC...
For consideration, yeah.
BCDC has kind of announced and
trying to build a strategy.
Certain ways that they're trying to kind of reevaluate how they address things like this, because they understand that they need to be partners and help get this stuff done rather than just simply putting up roadblocks and making everything more expensive. So that was that. Also, the general manager of Novato Sanatory, Sandeep, is it Karkal?
Karkal.
He spoke. And
really?
Yes. Because the meeting was at Novato Sanitary. He came up with a couple of mottos initially, creating worth from all of your waste, or something like that, all of our waste, to better serve our customers. To better serve our customers. I forgot that one. Anyway, another one was where your fecal matters. Your number two is our number one. We take crap from everyone. Anyway, he actually had a sense of humor, but I wrote that one down wrong. I'm sorry. Wow, I blew that one. Okay, Novato Sanitary. They do collection, treatment, and they deal with solid waste. So it's kind of, you know, they've got their hands in some other stuff that's up beyond what we do. Newish plant. It was built in 2011. State-of-the-art in 2011, $100 million. They do advanced secondary treatment, including ammonia removal. The flows are 7 million gallons a day average, 47 peak wet weather. They also have a reclamation program. All summer flows from the plant are sprayed onto pasture fields along Highway 37. More than 800 acres. There's also a pond there, and it's along the Pacific Flyway, so they get a lot of birds. The Deer Island, they have water out there that's tertiary treated, recycled water. So they actually do tertiary treating. Their recycled water program irrigates the Stone Tree Golf Course, the cemetery, the fire station, and soon the Marin Country Club. At the plant that they operate with North Marin Water District for tertiary treatment, it's 1.7 million gallons a day to tertiary Title 22 level, which is about the equivalent of 1,000 households annually. They run all their tertiary in purple pipe. North Marin Water District installed the purple pipe, and North Marin Water is the reuse authority. They're the partner, but they're the ones that kind of handle that. They have three main challenges. The agency has lost 20% of their staff to retirements in the last 6 months, which is brutal. They said challenge number two is regulatory climate, and number three, lack of state and federal funding. So they, that's pretty much it.
What is tertiary? Do you think ammonia removal makes it tertiary? Is that?
Most of the time, tertiary just means that you have an additional process, so you're going to remove more of the suspended solids and more of the VOD. And you're going to have a higher requirement for pathogen reduction. Nutrients are separate from tertiary.
He received a $90 million SRF loan.
So I remember that, yeah.
I wonder why he wants more of that for his plant.
So I am happy to make these reports more brief if you want me to. I know some people like to get into details in the past, other North Bay Watershed board members have gone into detail. Any thoughts about how much you want? Because I'm happy to make it.
Was that the most detailed version?
That was the most detailed version.
I would trust if you covered highlights.
Okay.
Yeah, or did it written?
Or you can, yeah.
Well, they post minutes, so you can always read it.
Available. Yeah. If you think something's relevant, I want to hear about it.
The minutes don't usually cover the presentation.
Okay. I know you like details, Michael, but I'm not sure everybody else does. So, May I make it more brief next time?
You may.
Thank you.
Save a little time. But tell the jokes.
But thank you.
I'll try to write them down properly next time. Sorry. All right. Next up, oral reports by commissioners. Anybody? General Manager, Jason.
Just a couple things. One is SRC's board did appoint Dean as their one of the representatives, and Al Boro down alternate. So congratulations, Dean. That's great.
Thank you.
Then the only thing I would mention, too, are these pieces of legislation. One is by Senator Wachowski. So remember a couple of years ago, he introduced some legislation, was enacted, and was associated with accessory dwelling units, and said if you have an accessory dwelling unit as part of the house, that a utility can't charge a connection fee. But if it's not part of the house, it's detached, they can charge a connection fee, but it's in proportion to fixture units or square footage. So that got enacted. So that for a lot of our agencies, that reduces the amount you can charge for a connection fee. Then there was some cleanup legislation last year that got enacted, and that added special districts to the legislation because that was left out. It was local agencies, so it didn't cover sanitary districts. So now they got covered last year. Now there's legislation that was brought up at our state legislative committee at CASA where Wachowski's revising that particular language in the government code and removing everything associating with the fees. And it just says an accessory dwelling unit is not considered another residence and cannot be charged any kind of a fee. So the question we have, okay, so that's obviously no connection fee, but what about a sewer service charge? Does that mean like you could have a big property and have a house, build a smaller house that connects to the sewer, so they don't get charged for the connection, which is buying into the infrastructure, and maybe you can't charge them for the sewer fee also, annual service charge fee. So that was pretty significant, so I thought I'd mention that. We'll track on this with the state ledge group. And then that the CalPERS board was considering legislation, sponsoring it, but they decided not to. SEIU is, the union, saying that if you're a JPA organization and you have unfunded pension liability, your JPA member agencies have to list the JPA agencies' unfunded liability on their financial statements, and that they would be joint and severally responsible. So that way, if the JPA dissolved, all the members be responsible for the pension liabilities.
No, in proportion?
No. Joint and several means that if one agency can't pay, then the other one's responsible.
So there wasn't any legislation on this. It was just some notes based on discussions with SEIU and the CalPERS board. But I guess there were some situations in Southern California, and they had this one HR JPA that was the JPA of these cities, and they provide HR services to these cities. And eventually that JPA stopped paying CalPERS for a couple years, something like that, and it dissolved, and they just laid off all their people. Then you had like 68 retirees that had this pension benefit. There's no agency to pay for it. So that's why they're looking at this legislation. So I mentioned to our state lobbyists that, well, if this is going to go forward, we need to get involved because a lot of JPA agencies have a lot of assets and infrastructure, and we just can't dissolve and go away, like CMSA and others. So anyway, I'll tell you how this evolves also.
So this is being sponsored by SEIU?
The union, yeah.
There is a related issue regarding the joint and several liability that is putting a wrench in the plans of putting down Larkspur to consolidate fire departments and create a new JPA. It's on hold because we can't get through CalPERS.
It's a broad issue.
Yeah.
Across many, many agencies.
Yeah.
But they're really cracking down.
And Marin has JPAs, a lot more JPAs than a lot of counties. We do a lot of things jointly.
So that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next meeting, March 13th. See you all then, unless there's anything else. All right, we'll adjourn.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.